In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, David Kramer, executive director of the George W. Bush Institute, discusses the unprecedented joint plea from 13 presidential foundations to revive democratic norms and civility in the U.S. Then, USA Today Justice Department reporter Bart Janssen on the sentencing this week of former Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio for his role in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Plus, Max Cohen, congressional reporter for Punchbowl News, previews the big spending battles to come on Capitol Hill this fall that could lead to another government shutdown. We begin with David Kramer, executive director of the George W. Bush Institute, on the unprecedented joint statement by several presidential libraries warning about the state of democracy in the U.S.
What was the impetus behind this statement? How did it come about and why now?
We actually thought about this a little over a year ago, and it then wound up on the shelf. And then this spring, we decided it was probably a good idea to dust it off, given the times that we're in these days. And so we updated it and then sent it around to our fellow presidential centers and foundations and got a very enthusiastic response. And there were a few small edits to it, but it more or less stayed the same as what we sent out. And we felt that given our unique positions as presidential centers, foundations, we had an obligation to come out and speak out and to try to get beyond the day-to-day headlines that we see and to remind fellow Americans that we are a great nation rooted in the ideals of freedom and democracy, and that we are best when we show compassion and tolerance and pluralism and respect for others, and that united, we're a much stronger country.
And your statement says that the U.S. is a, quote, house in disarray. What leads you to that conclusion?
There's no denying that our polarization is very high. We see very heated rhetoric these days, questions about the integrity of our institutions. And we believe that it's very important to try to restore and renew confidence and trust among Americans in our institutions. For example, we know how to conduct elections. And while there's been controversy about them, our elections actually are well run. We also want to try to restore trust in other democratic institutions. And equally important, we feel that we need to return to a sense of civility. There's no Pollyannish perspective on our past. There was a caning in the U.S. Senate chamber back in 1856. We went through a civil war in this country in the 1860s. It was only in the early 1900s that women were granted the right to vote. So our history has certainly been challenging throughout the years, but we have shown that we strive toward a more perfect union. And we just felt that in these rather challenging times, it was important to issue this rather positive statement that other centers could rally around.
David, you had an opinion in the Dallas Morning News with the headline, Americans who see bipartisanship as weak must find ways to come together. And you also point to gerrymandering as one of the causes of partisanship. Can you walk us through that connection?
Sure. So bipartisanship is very often necessary in order to get legislation passed through Congress and then signed by the White House, depending on the composition of the White House and the Congress. But bipartisanship has become seen as a dirty word, almost as a weakness on the side of some political figures, those who won't stick with their party no matter what. And so it's important to try to find some middle ground in order to get things done, in order to make sure that our democratic system of government delivers for average Americans. And so gerrymandering, however, drives our political figures toward one extreme or another. Basically, it is creating and carving up districts that play to either a Republican or a Democratic base. And it does not provide incentives for those political figures to move toward the middle. Instead, it is, frankly, an incentive for them to play to the extremes. And so gerrymandering over the years, it's not a new phenomenon. It's been around for about 200 so years. It is something that is increasing our polarization. And so it's something that I think needs to be addressed. We're seeing some court challenges about it in various states, and we'll see what happens with it in the future. But it's a hard thing to deal with because there are vested interests that don't want to see a change.
And former President Trump does not have a library yet. Was he invited to participate in this statement?
He was not because of the reason that you just cited. He doesn't have a foundation or a center. And so what we did was reach out to all the existing foundations and centers that are in the United States. And that, as you said in your opening, Mimi, goes back to Herbert Hoover. And so we're covering almost a century of presidents.
And how easy was it to get everybody to sign on? I mean, 13 is quite a good number of presidential libraries.
We were very pleased with the response. Equally important, it is very bipartisan. It was absolutely crucial to us that in order to issue this statement, we needed to have a bipartisan representation of former presidents and their centers and foundations. The response we got was very, very positive. People whom we reached out to felt that there was a need for such a statement. They felt now was, in fact, the time to issue this. And so we were very pleased with this. The response we've been getting has been very encouraging. We think there is a large majority of Americans out there who do want to see this system work effectively, are looking for reasonable voices who will handle debates and disagreements, which, by the way, are very vital to our democracy, but to do them in a civil manner. And so we want to emphasize the civility, the compassion, the tolerance, the pluralism, and also to remind Americans that for all our flaws and mistakes and our problems in the past, we do have a track record of striving toward a more perfect union. We go through difficult times. In the 1960s, we had major political assassinations, JFK, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and yet we somehow get through this because we are a great nation rooted in ideals, and that's where we want to remind our Americans of both our past and a look ahead as well.
Well, give me something concrete that you want the American public to do to further democracy, to further civility.
In our statement, we call on our political leaders, our political figures, to ensure that government works for Americans, to lead by example, to show that they can disagree with people on the other side of the political aisle in a civil manner. But for everyday Americans, you can get involved in a neighborhood group to clean up a nearby park, join the school committee or city council, join the military, join the government service in one form or another. There are many ways of participating, of contributing to the nation. Voting is also an important part of the political process here in the United States, as it is in any democratic society. Ensuring participation is really key to this. And so we want to make sure that Americans feel they do have a voice, that they are being heard. But it is both something that starts at the top, but also everyone it can be involved and needs to play a role in this. And that's something that we try to urge in this statement.
That was David Kramer, executive director of the George W. Bush Institute. Next, USA Today Justice Department reporter Bart Janssen discusses the 22-year prison sentence for former Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio for his role in the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
He was convicted of six charges, the most serious of which was seditious conspiracy. There was also conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, which, of course, was Congress counting the Electoral College votes, and also a couple of other interfering with police and damage to federal property. So the judge was sentencing a handful of Proud Boys defendants who were tried in April, convicted. Four of the five were convicted of seditious conspiracy. And so he's been handing down some of the longest, the judge, U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly, has been handing down some of the longest sentences yet in the January 6th riot.
When it comes to the 22 years that Mr. Tarrio received, how was that reached? What guidelines were given to, as far as that number is concerned?
Well, they total up the sentencing guidance for each of those charges, and then there were enhancements in one case for terrorism, meaning that the actions that he took were intended to influence the government through either intimidation or coercion. His lawyers obviously argued that he was not a terrorist. He was, not trying to use violent means to achieve his ends. But he was convicted of seditious conspiracy and the other charges. The judge, Kelly, ruled that terrorism could be applied. Kelly did say that he understood it wasn't trying to blow up buildings or kill people, but that the standards of interfering with the government applied. And so enhancements to the sentence were applied for that.
Did Mr. Tario address the court in any way?
He did. He spoke for several minutes. He apologized to law enforcement officers who he said, he was not trying to mistreat. He apologized to the citizens of D.C., saying that he wouldn't want his own city overrun with people in a riot. And he asked for mercy, saying he knew he was looking at a long sentence. His defense lawyers asked for no more than 15 years. He's 39 years old and asked the judge not to take away his 40s from him. But Judge Kelly, nevertheless, sentenced him to 22 years.
Did the judge respond to those pleas from him or his lawyers? What was the judge's tone during this time?
Well, he said he quibbled with the defense lawyers, saying they were basically trying to relitigate the case and saying, the jury already convicted you of these charges. You can't say you didn't do it. One of his defenses and an argument that his lawyers were making during the day yesterday was that he wasn't at the Capitol on January 6th. He had been arrested a couple of days before and left the city. He was in Baltimore. And his lawyers said that he did not contact people on January 6th, that he never directed anyone to assault the police and never directed anyone to destroy government property. But the judge said, he was convicted of leading this conspiracy, of basically organizing 200 people to come to Washington to, he would say, protest, but what became a riot and ransacking of the Capitol, and that he should have foreseen that kind of violence could erupt after directing those people here. So the judge dealt with each of the claims, but basically said that he wasn't buying it.
With the 22-year sentence that he received, how do you think that might influence further sentencings for those involved in January 6th?
Well, this recent flurry of sentences were essentially the leaders of the Proud Boys. So we had the 22-year sentence for Enrico Tarrio. We had an 18-year sentence for Joseph Biggs last week, a 17-year sentence 18 for Ethan Nordine, 17 for Joseph Biggs, 15 for Zachary Real. And so these have been among the longest. The longest before this last week was to the head of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, who got 18 years. And so I don't know if we have any defendants charged in the January 6th riot, and particularly now these convictions for seditious conspiracy, if there are anybody else out there looking at a longer sentence at this point.
Where do, as far as overall, the Department of Justice's cases against those who participated in January 6th, where do those defendants stand? How many have been sentenced? How many ongoing? Can you break that down for us?
Yes. There have been more than 1,100 people charged in the January 6th attack. More than 600 of those have been sentenced so far. Of course, many of those have been misdemeanors and many not including jail time. A lot had house arrest. But now, as we're getting farther and farther away from the attack, more of these serious cases have made their way through the courts. And so we're finally getting some resolution, some idea about how the most serious cases are playing out. The prosecutors have said they may charge nearly 1,000 more people from the attack. And so we'll have to keep watching who gets charged. But at this point, they have said that the leaders of the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys were really the leaders of the folks on the ground there.
Do any of these charges and what's been done when it comes to the attack itself, does it connect in any way to the potential legal issues that President Trump faces, particularly when it comes to January 6th activities?
Not yet. Trump was indicted on federal charges, four federal charges, which were essentially conspiracy to obstruct Congress and to try to defraud the United States, which means, you know, overturn the vote, take away people's votes. But he was not charged with seditious conspiracy. He was not charged with inciting the riot as he had been during the House impeachment actions. The House impeached him, saying he did incite the riot, but the Senate acquitted him, falling short of the votes needed to convict him. A majority voted for conviction, but it fell short of the two-thirds majority that was needed. So he has not yet been charged with actually inciting that riot. But of course, that investigation by Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith is continuing. And so we'll have to see. His trial on those conspiracy charges is scheduled for March 4th. He would like to move it later than that.
That was Bart Jansen, Justice Department reporter for USA Today. Now, Max Cohen, congressional reporter for Punchbowl News, previews the big spending battles ahead in Congress this month, especially the quickly approaching September 30th deadline to fund the government. But we started with the brand new $40 billion supplemental spending request from the Biden administration.
Ukraine spending, why is it part of this package?
Sure. So the White House wants to give more assistance to Ukraine. In the spending battle, there have been some restraints on how much you can raise money in defense spending. So another avenue to get more aid to Ukraine, military, economic, is through this supplemental request. And that's one way Democrats, the White House, and also many Senate Republicans and more mainstream Republicans want to do this. But it's crucial in the House. You have a big faction of Freedom Caucus types Republicans who say we shouldn't be sending money to Ukraine. We should be focusing on the United States itself, focusing on crises they cite at the border, for instance. So that's the kind of dynamic here.
That way, I want to ask you about the second part, border security being part of that, and then also weave in how that relates to disaster relief as well.
Yeah, so the White House kind of was twinning together a bunch of things here, trying to make the bet what can win over Republican support. So I think the border security measures was a play by the White House to say, look, let's get some bipartisan support here. If we can give some things that are priorities that Republicans have, maybe they'll support some things that are seen as Democratic priorities. And the disaster aid, of course, you know, wildfires recently in Hawaii and elsewhere throughout the country, disaster relief is an important issue to replenish funds that FEMA has. And FEMA says, look, we need more money to help deal with these natural disasters across the country.
As far as the timeline in the Senate, since they're back from break, what do we expect to see as far as activity on these various measures?
Yeah, it's really tough to say right now because the House is a key component here. But what I would say is, some expect this $40 billion supplemental request to be twinned with a short-term continuing resolution to fund the government. So we're looking at kind of an end-of-September timeline, in my opinion, for action on this and also an effort to stop a government shutdown.
Thank you for the segue. The continuing resolution, talk about it and what's the danger of the government actually shutting down because of a lack of money?
Yeah, I think we need to really be realistic that there is a real danger of the government shutting down simply because there's a difference between the House and the Senate on this issue. We talked to a bunch of senators. Last night I was talking to Republican senators who told me they were concerned by what they saw from House Republicans in the sense that House Republicans are demanding some very partisan aspects in return for their vote for a continuing resolution, which really would only be to extend the deadline from September, end of September to middle of November, right? We're not looking to really pass a full year spending bill yet. We're just kind of punting a little bit. Some of the House Republicans have said, look, if I want to vote to continuing resolution, I need an impeachment inquiry against President Joe Biden. Or I need, you know, defunding the Jack Smith special counsel, things which will not pass the Senate, no way, right? So we're looking at a big difference. And the Senate, as we kind of said in the intro, they're more unified than the House at the moment because both Republicans and Democrats largely want to keep the government open. But there are a bunch of House Republicans who said, a government shutdown, that's okay with me if it means some of these programs we don't agree with aren't funded.
When it comes to that shutdown being okay, do either Speaker McCarthy or Minority Leader McConnell buy into that?
Definitely not Minority Leader McConnell, and I'd say definitely not Speaker McCarthy, although he's not saying as forcefully as McConnell, right? I think McCarthy wants to govern. He wants to show the country that House Republicans, who you know only have a very narrow majority, that they can lead the country, that they can govern. He doesn't want to shut down, but many of his members, I think, on the right of his conference would be okay with that. So he needs to really thread the needle here. And what he's done in past months is give some red meat to his Republican members. We saw that in the NDAA, for instance, right? In the debt limit fight. Give some concessions on conservative wish list priorities in order to get a larger bill passed. We might see that again.
That was Punchbowl News congressional reporter Max Cohen. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.